Before we get to this episode, just to say thanks to everyone who's bought my new book, Champion Thinking, How to Find Success Without Losing Yourself. Published by Bloomsbury, the response has been terrific. It's an Amazon bestseller. It's been top 20 in the airport charts consistently, and the reviews have been terrific right across the board. And if you like this episode that you're about to hear on Flow, you'll be sure to enjoy Champion Thinking. Head to my website, simonmundy.com, or Amazon, Waterstone, Smith's, places like that, to get your copy.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello and welcome to Life Lessons from Sport and Beyond. Simon here, and this week I'm delighted to be joined by the former world champion boxer, Josh Warrington. Now, Josh has arguably the most important fight of his career against Mauricio Lara on Saturday, September 4th at Headingley Stadium. It is a rematch after Josh suffered a shock defeat to the Mexican in February, the first of his career. Now, the theme of this episode is about making good choices, which is something Josh has done consistently throughout his life and career, even when his mind was telling him he was missing out. We also talk about getting perspective in your life, stopping complaining about things that are really unimportant in the big scheme of things, and why having no regrets when you're older is something worth striving towards. Josh shares some compelling stories about the power of the mind, and in particular, the power of visualization, and we discuss why switching off is so important and why that was a big factor in his shock defeat to Lara during lockdown in February. Now, before we get to this episode, just a reminder about this week's newsletter, in which I talk about a visualization technique I use and how to get out of your own way to allow your nervous system to settle during times of stress. Head to simonmundy.com to sign up for Monday on a Monday. Thanks for your messages about last week's episode with Cal Newport about regaining control of our digital lives to reduce anxiety, improve focus, and overall well-being. Let me know what you make of this week's conversation too at Simon Mundy on social media. And if you could please share this episode with someone who might enjoy it, or if you could share it on social media, I would be hugely grateful. To this week's episode now though, and here is Josh Warrington. Josh Warrington, how are you, mate?
Very well, Simon. Very well. Thanks for having me on.
Hey, it's an absolute pleasure having you on. You and I, obviously, we've got a few things in common. First of all, ex-Leeds University students. We've got that in common. Yeah. WWF fans.
All right, yeah.
Here's a question for you. Who is your favourite WWF / WWE wrestler?
Stone Cold Steve Austin.
Where does Ric Flair rank?
Oh, he's up there, he's up there. Probably when the highlight of him was probably a little bit before my time.
I had Ric Flair on the podcast.
Right, well, that's a bit of a big name, isn't it?
I've never met a character like him. He was absolutely incredible.
Did you get him to do the woo?
Absolutely, yeah. He filmed a little video of woos for me. No, he's an amazing bloke. So we'll get to the Leeds Uni stuff because I think that's really interesting in a minute as well. But I want to start, Josh, with your love of boxing. I've got a quote of yours here.
Yep.
And correct me if it's wrong, but it reads, "It's a funny old game getting punched in the head for a living. For some reason, it's addictive.
Yep.
When it comes to fighting, I feel so alive."
Yeah. Yeah.
So what is it, do you think, about boxing that gives you that feeling of being so alive? Can you put your finger on it?
That's a very good question. I think it's a collective of a few things, to be fair, Simon. I think it's a collective of the adrenaline, the rush, the fact of you're on your own. There's nobody else there with you. You're going into combat, and it's not just a competition, it's physical competition. It's competition where if you're not up to the plate, then you're going to get hurt. You're going to real feel the effects of it. Not like a race. If you know you come second, then you know you don't get a shiny gold medal. You get a silver instead. If you come second in boxing, then more than likely you'll have had a bust nose, a black eye, and a bit of an hard lesson. It's a rush. It's a complete rush. And now I've had a beer in my life. I've never taken drugs. But I don't think there's anything what I've had what's come close to the feeling of getting ready for the occasion of walking to the ring. The introductions and that split second before that first bell rings, that is something that no other feeling replicates and comes close to it. And that's probably where that's what I'm talking about when I say there's nothing like it.
To what degree do you think it is the fact that you are lost in the moment? You're not thinking about the future. You're not thinking about the past. You're completely immersed in the activity itself.
As soon as I step off the scales, that's it. I'm zen. I'm kind of there in the moment. So not right now, you know, I've just had kettle on, I've had a cup of tea, I'm here speaking to you, I'm laid back. I might have other appointments on, but I'm pretty much laid back. If it gets stuck in traffic, I'm stuck in traffic. It's, you know, it's fine. When I get off the scales before the fight, that's when I'm most alive. Because for me, boxing has been a massive, massive part of my life. And it's like all my life has been structured around boxing. Apart from a few things like meeting my missus and things like that, even she has had a factor with boxing. She's played her life around boxing as well. So it always comes down to that next fight. And as soon as I get off the scales, then that's it. But in that moment, in that 12 to 24 hours, my senses really pick up. I'm hearing noises, not like I'm a clairvoyant or anything like that, but I'm a lot sharper. Colours are a lot brighter. It's like I've got just a sudden and slow rush of adrenaline, what's constantly teetering through my body. And then I'm just everywhere. I'm absolutely everywhere. Like, I'll go out in the car, I'll be driving along, I'm alert, I'm looking, checking my mirrors, I'm checking my surroundings, but I'm just doing what I'm doing. Whereas if I'm driving on fight day, I'm all over the place. I can see what an old fella's doing 100 meters down the road, as well as ticking all my senses. It's an unreal feeling. Why do I feel like that? Well, it's how much the fight means to me, because I put that much pressure plus focus on that fight. I've been training for months and months and months, and it always comes down to that next fight. Nothing else matters after that, because in boxing, it's unlike any other sport where if you get beat at Wimbledon, you get next year to have a go at it. If you're losing football, you've got another match next week. If you're getting beat in boxing, you're finished. No matter if it's your first one or not, you're finished. You know, people say someone's wrong or he's lost it or whatever, and it can take a long, long time to get back. Now, I realise that. I understand that it's a business as well as a sport. So for me, winning is absolutely everything. And that's where it gives me that adrenaline, that rush, that focus, that everything what comes down to that single moment. It's like, I never look past that one night. Sunday doesn't exist. It's just people talk about what they're about doing next week. It doesn't exist for me.
Because so time drops away.
Completely. Everything just stops. And it just, I am fully in that moment. I am fully aware of the whole situation in that moment.
It's an interesting thing that I hear a lot speaking to a lot of sports people, is that sense of really getting lost in the moment, of almost losing your sense of self in the moment.
Yes.
Past, future. So if I think of probably your most acclaimed fight in terms of entertainment, so against Carl Frampton, yep, which was the fight of the year, while you were in the middle of that fight, yes, what is your experience? Because you're not thinking about, I imagine, tomorrow night, you're not thinking about yesterday. Are you thinking at all?
Yeah, you're thinking. You are definitely thinking. It's a fine balance because over the years, I've learned to deal with keeping the horse blinkers on and not getting distracted. By the time I had the Carl Frampton fight, to a lot of people, it's the first time they've seen me. It's on the big stage. But for myself and a lot of my other fans, or followers, should I say, you know, that's 10 years down the line, 9 years down the line. So, and I've been in the limelight, in certainly in Leeds, for, you know, a good 4 to 5 years prior to that. And, you know, I didn't have no sporting school on how to deal with the mental side. I've learned on the job. So, for instance, I'm going off on a tangent here, but just giving an idea of a situation. I came through very quickly. I was still working a 9-to-5 job when I was European champion. I was headlining shows on Sky Sports on a Saturday night, prime time. And then I was going to work on Monday morning making teeth as a dental technician. So it was unheard of. People were coming to work and saying, "You weren't telling on weekend what you doing here?" I'd be like, "This is my day job." And then I've gone from small old shows, fighting in front of 1,000 people, in leisure centres, things like that. And then all of a sudden, I'm fighting in the Leeds Arena, 10,000 people. I'm doing national press. I've got likes of Leeds United footballers, past and present, doing ring walk for me. Vinnie Jones in one occasion. It's going to get to you eventually, no matter who you are, especially if you've not had like media training or come from that kind of background. So I remember one fight specifically, 2015, where I've walked out. All of that build-up, I've been touted as the next Ricky Hatton. He's a Ricky Hatton of Leeds. He's got this crazy fan base behind him. He's going to go to the top. He's going to emulate what Ricky Hatton does. He's only young, but he's already European champion. I was still working. I was having to ask my gaffer if I could have 10 minutes extra on my dinner time because I'm doing an interview with Oxby and Jacobs on TalkSport. You know, that's the scenario I was at. So I'm still going from a day-to-day basis. Next minute, I'm doing documentaries for Ringside. Sky Sports News are doing interviews with me. And I find myself walking to the ring with 10,000 people in Leeds Arena, massive pressure on my shoulder. Now, one of them fights in particular stands out for me where I was thinking about so many factors in that fight. I'm looking at my man in the corner. I'm thinking I need to beat him. Obviously, normally all the things that I think of, you know, what's he going to do? The boxing side of it. What's he going to do after this shot? What am I going to do if I throw this shot? But then I'm thinking about what could come after this fight for me? What could come for my career, financial, profile? I'm thinking about how I'd fancy a McDonald's after this fight. All these different things are going through my head. And
really?
Then halfway through the fight, I'm winning the fight comfortably. But I noticed the crowd have gone a bit quiet. And I'm thinking, why has the crowd gone quiet? There's 10,000 here that were roaring 3 rounds ago. Now they've gone quiet. I think I need the knockout. I need to be more entertaining. So I'm pushing so hard. By the end of the fight, mate, I was absolutely exhausted. Now, I won the fight on all judges' scorecards and I won it quite comfortably. But the pundits absolutely roasted me. They said that I was reckless. They said I didn't look at the races. And they said that if I was to go forward, then I'd need to change something in my game plan. Now, we came away from that fight and analysed things as a team. And I started to work on really putting the horse blinkers on and just focusing on the moment and just the man in front. And a lot of things like meditation, visualisation, things like that all come into play. And the next fight I had was a tougher opponent. And there were like, I think there were about 8,000 people in the ring that time, but we could have just fought behind closed doors. It felt like nobody there. And I've tried to adopt that mindset into every single fight I've had since that. But there is times when, you know, you forget yourself and you can hear the crowd. So going back to your question there with Carl Frampton, I was in there and I was focused, but then after around 4 or 5 rounds with an explosive fight, explosive start. The fans are going absolutely berserk. There's 20,000 in Manchester. He's got 10,000. I've got 10,000. And there's pockets of that where I can hear his fans, and there's pockets of it where I can hear my fans. And there is times when I'm thinking to myself, wow, this is absolutely fantastic. I'm having an absolute barnstorming with a former pound for pound great, you know, in Carl. But I'm loving myself. But then it's like, right, get back switched on. So you do teeter in and out of it, but I think over the years I've learned to, you know, stay pretty strict on it.
So sometimes you're really in the moment, and then sometimes your mind does wander, which is natural, of course. That's interesting. And something I really like about you and Carl, and Carl's been on, and he's a really nice, down-to-earth guy. And I think both of you share that in common, that humility. Yes. And I think in boxing, and in a lot of sports, particularly boxing, though, let's say, where there is some people feel that they need to, understandably perhaps, sell the fight, drum up a bit of noise around it. But with you and Carl, there was that respect, that humility. You're both down to earth and you had that in common. And I really admire that. I admire that with any sports person who's achieved great things. The people I admire most are the ones who are humble with that.
Yeah.
That applies to any other area of life as well. So anyone who has major success but stays humble. And you and Carl have that in common.
Yeah, most definitely. Most definitely. I think, you know, Carl comes from a working class background. I come from a working class background. Where you come from can have a lot to do with it. But me and Carl have, you know, we just keep things as humble. We don't have that second persona or metamorphosis kind of persona where we become a different character. What you see is kind of what you get. And, but I think boxing's got a funny way of doing that. I think maybe if you speak to people's dads or granddads, you know, used to have a scrap on the cobbles back in the day. Normally, even as a kid, you have a scrap in the playground. If you've had an hard battle, then you get back up and you shake hands. I think, you know, a lot of the time these days is about, oh, we'll go get our pals and get revenge. You know, boxing, it humbles you because of you're getting an hard lesson. You're getting physical punishment at the time, and it's an art and it's a science, but it is a very hard sport at the same time. And a lot of boxers, you know, the most percentage of boxers come from working class backgrounds. And I think the difference between that and maybe if like footballers and stuff is we don't have academies and stuff around us where you have agents and everything else doing absolutely everything for you. Like I said to you earlier, a lot of us work full-time jobs and we get to an high level. One of my pals has pointed out in the past where he said that boxing's a funny sport because you can be the one where you're headlining shows, but you might not be able to afford the Sky subscription. You look at darts players or golf players or tennis players, you think any one of them could afford the Sky bill a month, but some fighters on there only fighting every 3 months probably can't even afford to do that. So it does keep you humble.
How much do you value humility more broadly? Because after your shock defeat against Maurizio Lara, which we'll come to in a bit, and obviously you've got a very good chance, shall we say, of getting revenge. Yeah. And I've got my theories as well about what happened there, but we'll get to them later, all right?
Okay, mate.
But obviously all the messages you got from your fans, I know you prefer to sort of call them people rather than fans as well, which I think sort of says a lot. Because like if I get emails from people who listen to the podcast and they say they enjoy it, to me, they're no less important than the people I speak to. I think everyone's on a par.
Yeah,
and I think when you don't lose sight of that, okay, you might have achieved whatever in life, but that doesn't make you any more important than the guy next door who's got a paper round. Do you know what I mean? And that seems to be a value and an attitude that you have.
Yeah, most definitely, most definitely. You know, keeping myself grounded, working as you know, as long as I did do. I only quit work like 5 or 6 years ago. The people I have around me, my old fella, he's my main trainer, but he's very, very open and honest with me as well. My friends, they still take the mick out of me. There's no, I don't have too many yes men around me. Do you know? And that helps.
Which
that
is
helps.
Really important, that,
yeah,
isn't it?
Definitely, yeah, definitely. You need to have some truths because you can run away with yourself. You can run away with yourself just getting carried away with fame, with people wanting you. When you become a product, you know, it's easier to think that you're bigger than everyone else. But same time, like, I do a lot of work.
Yeah, you start to believe it.
Yeah, of course, yeah. But then at the same time, I do a lot of work with charities. And now, not because, you see a lot of people who do work for charities because it raises the profile, makes them look good. Where you go along to an hospital and post for some pictures and blah, blah, blah. And yeah, right, are we done now? Yeah, fair enough. Let me put that on my Instagram. Yeah, bang on, look at that. Look how good I am. It's a bit fake, isn't it? You know, it's just like half-assed, you know. But I do it because, you know, I can put a smile on people's faces here. I do a lot with, like, children's charities. I'm an ambassador of many children's charities. Because for me, children... you know, they should be just out playing rather than having to deal with problems they are doing, whether it's cancer or heart problems or whatever it is. I've seen all sorts over years. But little things like that, just going and visiting the hospitals keeps you grounded. And then when you see and speak to likes of nurses and doctors who either are just starting a 12-hour shift after just finishing a 14-hour shift, gone home and had 6 hours sleep and then come back in, and they're saving people's lives. And then you come away and you think, what is it all about? We are heroes, you know? And as some people say, oh, you're a legend, Josh, you're a legend. Mate, I am a legend. Get yourself down to St. James's Hospital. Get yourself down to Leeds General Infirmary and you'll see wards of legends right there who don't get the same perks. So I often think like that, you know what I mean? And that's what, if I ever start thinking like, oh, you know, like I've got a bit of my chip on my shoulder, just remind myself of things like that. And sometimes you forget about that because maybe you haven't been to hospital in a long time, or maybe you don't, you know, people who are just happy and healthy. But there comes to that stage where something might happen to a friend or a family or even yourself, and all of a sudden everything gets put out a window. You're people who you think you're heroes aren't your heroes no more. And it's like little people like that, your everyday folk who you're real heroes, you know.
Just wondering then, in terms of the value you get from going to hospitals like that, if someone was feeling really down in the dumps, let's say they were feeling a bit sorry for themselves, would you encourage someone like that to go and volunteer, to go and go to a hospital like this, to give back? Does it give you that lift? Does it give you that sense of perspective? Does it give you a sort of sense of intrinsic reward?
Yeah, most definitely. Most definitely. And I've said that for many times and... I can't hear anyone carry on about silly little things ever again because it winds me up. I can hear people carrying on about the littlest of things, you know, even, oh, I need these new pair of shoes, or I've got a flat tire on my car, and it's like, listen, you know, oh yeah, it's a little bit upsetting, but you shouldn't really deter your emotions too much. And often I think to myself, when people are carrying on, just come down to the hospital with me. Come down to me at the hospital, and that'll really put life into perspective. How lucky you are, or, you know, you might think, oh, I don't have much, or I don't have a nice car as what they do, or I don't have nice trainers or what they do. Be grateful for what you've got. Be grateful if you've got a pair of trainers, or if you can put a meal in your belly, you know, if you've got a nice house, if you've got friends and family around you. How many people do we know who suffered from depression because... Well, you probably don't know because it's to keep themselves quiet, but because they're not speaking to other folk, they're not having interaction. Now, like I say, I go down to the hospitals and I see kids smiling and happy, and they're going in for life-changing operations the next day. And I've walked in with my shiny belt and I'm looking at the parents, and the parents are putting on a brave face, and now just becoming a parent myself, I'm like, I can't believe how they do it, you know, how strong they are. But I look at the kids and I come over, hello, I'm Josh Warrington, there's my shiny belt, I look here, I do a bit of boxing, and I look at them, and they're not batting an eyelid what's going on to them. You know, I go into cancer wards and stuff and see kids who've been through hell and back, but they've still got a smile on their face. And it's like, wow. Wow, it really makes you put life into perspective. Now, I remember going to the art ward at Leeds General Infirmary a few years ago. I was having a visit on one of the wards, and I went into one of the intensive care wards, and I went over to a dad who was sat bedside by his kid, and it was a bit of a delicate situation, but I just I'd asked what's going on and if he was okay. And he said, you know, his kid, he dropped him off that morning and he was setting off to work. And about 10 minutes after leaving school, he got a phone call from the school and his six-year-old boy had an heart attack in playground. And there they were, sat in hospital. And it's like, wow, how your life can suddenly flip. So, I feel like I'm going pretty deep here, but I think certainly when you visit places like that, then you don't have to put things into perspective of what's really important. You know, little things like just living, breathing, and having the little things what we take for granted, good health, food in our bellies. Don't take little things like that for granted, because people would absolutely give anything to just be in that situation.
Yeah, I don't think you can get much more of an important point, actually, than what you've just said there. Just getting a bit of perspective. We're so determined to keep up with the Joneses, and we are so inclined to compare ourselves to people, particularly around us. But like you say, there are people out there who would just love to have health.
Yeah,
and we can easily lose sight of that. I want to now then just ask you as well, Josh, I'll take you back a little bit, because obviously, so you grew up on a council estate in Leeds.
Yes.
And, you know, there was a lot of, shall we say, bad behaviour on your council estate. I know there was, you know, people getting up to mischief. So when boxing found you, how easy did you find it to resist temptations that were around you? And what advice would you have for anyone in a similar position? Because I know, and I want to come to you, the quote that the mate of yours said when you were 22, which was really formative. But I know, we all know, when your mates are out doing something, it's that fear of missing out or whatever.
Yeah, of course.
It's such a human, normal reaction.
Yeah.
So you must have had that. But how did you keep focused throughout that whole time?
So boxing, I'd been doing it as a young age, from around 6 or 7. But at that age, he's kind of dibbling and dabbling in and out of it, you know. Going to gym, like, oh, I don't want to go tonight, Dad. I want to go play out with my friends. I think got to my stage where my old fella said, listen, if you're going to do it, you do it or you don't do it. Don't waste my time taking you down to the gym. Don't waste the people who train you. Don't waste their time as well. So you do it or you don't. So I kind of got myself regimented into going to boxing, to going to training 3 times a week. I felt like I couldn't give it up. When I wasn't doing it, I missed it. And obviously there were times as a young kid where you just wanted to play out in the estate. Then you start high school around 11, 12, 13, 14. It's an age where adolescent years, everyone's growing at different rates. It's an experiment in time, isn't
up
it?
To all,
you know?
Sorts, yeah.
Yeah, of course, of course. And no, I grew up in not the most glamorous of areas in Leeds. Now, the lads who I hung about with, it was always in the area. And at 14, 15, they were doing all sorts, drinking, smoking, taking odd recreational. And in a big circle, it's easy to get drawn into that. And I seen it firsthand. The most talented footballers who wouldn't say boost to a goose or wouldn't ever curse in front of their mum and dad all of a sudden become a bad man or didn't mind doing whatever. And I don't know if I had a wise head on young shoulders. I do often think like that, but I was always looking down the line. And in a diagram in your head, you've got to maybe a way up. Well, how will this affect me instantly? And how is it going to affect me long term? That's how I used to kind of look at things. So for instance, you go to an house party on a Friday, Saturday night, mum and dad have gone away for a weekend, some young lad's got keys to his house, that's it. They're getting his older brother to go to local Tesco's, all getting a little bit drunk, a little bit tipsy, and they're getting their older brother to go get him a pack of fags and whatever, you know, a couple of smokes, and it's all going off. But for myself, and I hung around with that circle, but it was like, I looked and I weighed up. Now, I remember having a little drink as a kid, but I didn't like the experience of throwing up the next day. You know, I watched other people smoke and I thought to myself, why is he doing that? He's always talked about how he detests smoking. His mum and dad smoked, he didn't like it. All of a sudden he's smoking. Why is he doing that? And weigh it up. Well, he's smoking because he wants to fit into that circle. Well, if that's only way, the reason that they consider him as a friend because of smoke, then I wouldn't want to be in that circle. A lot of times, a lot of lads are young about with as well. I could kind of see straight through him. You know, a lot of lads felt that they put themselves on a pedestal as this lad because they had an older brother or an older cousin who was cock at estate, who could have a bit of a scrap. So if any time trouble come on his toes, then he'd just phone his older brother or he'd go get his older cousin, and then you won't mess with him because you'd be messing with his older brother and cousin. So he thought he were a god. You know, he thought he couldn't be messed with, or there'd be another cool lad on the estate who always had the smart trainers and smart coat and smart jacket and brand new phone. Yeah, you know, and he could take the mick out of you because he had a brand new gear and you didn't have it. But then I'd wait up again. Well, in 5 years' time, when we get to like 18, 19, is your brother still going to be looking after you and coming to deal with your problems? Is your mum still going to be buying you brand new trainers, brand new phones, brand new coats? So that was where I was able to see past who the cool kids were. You know, don't get me wrong, I hang about with all these people, but I quickly realised that was it doing me any favours? So I changed my circle from then and I started hanging it in different areas. You know, things that were going to benefit me. And it sounds like a bit selfish, but I see it all the time and I hear it all the time, and especially when I go for talks with kids, and I see it with young kids where they're easily led and vulnerable because maybe an older kid might have them doing this and other. Maybe something illegal, so maybe something naughty. They're doing it to fit in. When, if it's not benefiting you, then why are you doing it? Why are you doing it? And even when you're getting older, if you've got toxic friends, or if they've got them friends in your life what are constantly mourning or sulking or carrying on about situation, get them out of your life, man, because there's plenty of people who will want to speak to you, who want to be friends, who have similar interests in you. I mean, there's like 63 million people in England alone. You know, there's plenty of people out there who you can speak to. Maybe in an older age, maybe a younger age, but there might be similar characters out to you out there. So you can make that change. You can make that change. And I realized that as a young lad that I had different goals of where I wanted to be in life. I didn't want to be hanging about on street corners when I was 17, 18. By that age, I thought that I might have a few good grades under my belt. I might be working, and I'd be probably looking to where I want to go with a career. Whereas these lot, they're the life of hustling for the rest of the life, you know what I mean? Or maybe relying on the mums or older brothers.
You are right. You did clearly have always had a wise head on your shoulders. I think to clock or have that attitude at a young age is rare. But I think for anyone young, perhaps listening to this, it's such a valuable outlook because as anyone above the age of 25, 35 in my case, and the rest, and knows time flies.
Yes.
Time absolutely flies.
And I'll tell you a quick, sorry, Sam, I'll tell you a quick story of that because when I often wonder why I had like a bit of a bit of serious headers on young shoulders. But I remember as a young amateur, when I used to box. Now, as a young amateur, you used to fight all over the country. You know, you'd fight in these little working men's clubs. You know, some areas glamorous, some of them little towns, some big cities. These were the days when you were allowed to smoke in these working men's clubs, when they were packed out, when the working men's clubs were working men's clubs, and they'd have a boxing ring in one of the main halls, and you know there'd be a fog of smoke over the ring because everyone were, you know, puffing away and then having the pints. And you know, as a young lad, I'd have a fight, I'd get out the ring, I'd go get my trophy, you know, win or lose. And 9 times out of 10, someone would always collar me. And it'd always be an older gentleman. Sometimes it'd be an older woman, but I'd always hear the same thing. Hey, young'un, come here. Come here, young'un. So I'd go over, shy a little bit, you know, my trophy. And they'd say, hey, keep doing what you're doing. Keep doing what you're doing. I tell you, keep doing what you're doing. You're doing all right, kid. You're doing all right. And I'd hear that a lot. And I'd often hear as well, listen, if I'd have my time again, I'd be doing what you're doing. You know, often some people would say, I ended up getting with this and hold up a pint glass or then I met these lot and point to the group of the friends or they'd say, oh, she dragged me down, you know, pointing to the missus. But I'd hear it a lot and I'd say it to my dad. I said, Dad, why are all these people always saying this? He said it again to me tonight. I hear it all the time. Every time I go to a show, they always say to me, "Stick what you're doing. It goes fast." What do they mean? He says, "Listen, you won't realise it because you're only young, but when you get to a certain age, life just goes a lot faster." And he said, "Before you know it, you've got everything in front of you, all your life in front of you. You're gonna do this. You're gonna do that. You're gonna do that. Before you know it, you settle down. You've got a house, and all your dreams and aspirations have disappeared." So he said, "Whatever you do, make sure you grasp it right there and then." And I've kind of taken that from a younger age. And I've thanked all them fellas in the workmen's clubs back in the day for giving me that.
I'd say I really respect your dad and the relationship you had with your dad, because obviously he's been your trainer the whole way through. And I think it speaks volumes that you ignored people who said, "Oh, you need a new trainer, you need someone with more experience," and you ignored that. So you're obviously really good at listening to your own intuition. But I think it really speaks volumes for the relationship you had that these kind of conversations that are really valuable conversations, and that you actually took them on board. And can you just share the story as well of when you were 22 and your mates were going out on the toot, and you were said to them, "Oh, you know, I wish I could be joining you." And one of them turned around and said something that really stuck with you and really perhaps hammered home that lesson that all the working men, all the chaps in the working men's club had said. Can you just share that story? Because I think it just really reinforces what you just said.
Yeah, no problem. So I was at a stage of life, young prime, 21, 22 year old. You know, I had quite a bit going for me. I was working as a dental technician 4 days a week. I was a day release at Leeds University studying dental technology. I'd fallen into that job because I wanted to be a professional boxer, but professional boxing at the bottom of the chain, there's no money in it really. So financially, I couldn't support my training and everything else going forward without a day job. So I had also, my old fella said to me, "You need someone to fall back on." And at school, I was quite well academically. So, you know, I fell into this job as a dental technician. I started working, and the gaffer said to me, "Listen, if you want to progress in this field, you're gonna have to get qualified in it." So I ended up going to Leeds University, doing a 4 years career, 4 year course in it. So 18, I've turned pro, and I'm working as a dental technologist. By the time I got to 21, 22, I'm around three years deep as a professional boxer, 4 years deep as a professional boxer. I'm more or less ready to fight for titles, but not quite there. I'm building a bit of a name for myself, you know, amongst little circles in Leeds, but nothing ridiculous. I'm getting odd little column in Yorkshire Evening Post, the Leeds local paper, but not like big broadsheets. I'm not in back page Yorkshire Evening Post quite yet. And my life at that moment in time is go to work 4 days a week, go to Leeds University 1 day a week. I either go running before work, go to work, then I train after, or I go to work, I train, and if I'm not training, I'm out trying to promote myself. That being selling tickets, going around the pubs of Leeds, putting posters up, meeting people in different circles, telling everyone about myself. "Do you like boxing? Yeah, you used to watch the Isles of Ben and Chris Eubank? Yeah, well, I'm from Leeds. I'm trying to put Leeds on the map." I do that most days a week. And in between all that, I was trying to have a relationship with my now wife, Natasha. And in that time, I was you know, doing 3,000 to 5,000 word essays on dental technology and anatomy of the jaw and anatomy of materials, what was made to make teeth. And wow, it were all overwhelming for me. And it was a time when I had no free time to myself, and I was constantly on the rush, constantly 10 minutes late wherever I went, always stuck in traffic, battling traffic. I need to get this next destination. Right, I'd finish training. Right, I better get myself in bed because I've got to get up for a run next morning, or I've got work next morning. Going to work, absolutely knackered with black eyes. Going to lectures, falling asleep in lectures because I've only had like 6 hours sleep, and I've just been helping someone who's fighting for a European title. and I've done 12 rounds with them the night before, and now I'm studying, listening to a 2-hour lecture like in a dark room. and it was a stage when I was getting ready for a fight and I was out selling tickets, because without building a fan base, you know, there's, like I said, there's no money in it. So you've got to create money to have people attend to watch you. Now, that'll pay for your opponent, and maybe if you're lucky, you might get a wage out of it yourself. But it's not glamorous at the lower level, believe me. And I remember dropping some tickets off to one of my pals who I went to school with, and I remember saying to him, "You looking forward to that party this weekend?" And he was like, yeah. And I thought, you don't sound that enthusiastic about it. You know, everyone's going to this big party. I think it would be someone's 21st birthday, and they'd rented out one of the big clubs in Leeds. And I think they had a rich uncle or someone who looked after them. You know, they were having a top-class DJ look after them and blah, blah, blah. So everyone I knew was going but myself. And I was gutted about that, because everyone on Facebook were talking about it, everyone on, you know, group texts and that were talking about it, and I was gutted. Like, everyone I was dropping tickets off were going. And I said to this lad, I said, "Are you not excited, you know?" He said, "Yeah, never mind that. How's training going? Looking forward to it." I didn't want to talk about training. I wanted to know how he was getting prepared for this party, how excited and what he was going to wear and how he was going to look forward to. But all he wanted to do was hear about how my training's going in preparation. And he cut me off a little bit. He said, "Listen, Josh, you keep going on about this party and, like, you seem more excited about this and apart from your fight." And I said, "Listen, I just wish I could be there, to be honest with you. You know, I've got..." He said, "Never mind that." He says, "It'll be the same old." He says, "We've been doing the same old since 18-year-old. Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday. Same face, same old faces. Again, this party is going to have the same old faces. Doing the same old stuff. Talking about the same old things. Yeah, you know, might have a little dance and that, but we've been doing it for the last 4 years. Look what you're doing. You're doing something with your life. It means something." He says, "Any one of us would give whatever to be in your position. Look at me. I could have played football. Look at me now. I've let my career go." He said, "Be proud, Josh, because we all are. We're all proud of how dedicated you've been throughout." And you know what? Right at that moment in time, it gave me the boost I needed. Because at that time, I was sat at work, and there were times in lectures I was thinking, what is this all about? I'm putting all my time into absolutely everything. You know, I've got another year and a half of university. You know, my work, I'm doing all right, but I don't feel like I'm climbing the ladder. My fights, I keep getting told that I'm going to be fighting for titles, but it seems like a million miles away. It's like, what is it all about? I'm not getting any further forward. But that talk, what he gave to me, especially with the lad being at my age and come from the same background as myself, it was a massive kick up the ass what I needed right there and then. And you know what? It gave me the energy to get me head down for the rest of for that remaining year and a half of university. So I went on to graduate. And same year as I went on to graduate, I got a shot at the English title. And then my fan base had really grown up, blew up from there. And next thing I know, I'm selling out the local Leeds Town Hall, fighting in front of 5,000 or 6,000 people. And it was all worth it, but I wouldn't have done it if it wasn't for the energy that he gave me in that moment in time. Just a reminder of, you know, you can get lost on your own little journey and think that you're not progressing anywhere. Because a lot of time people want overnight success. They want to be at the top of the tree in whatever business or job sector they're doing, but it doesn't always work like that. And there is a long slog, but, you know, sometimes you need to pull yourself out of a situation or maybe speak to your friends and have their opinion on it. And that certainly for me was, you know, a great opinion. He was proud of what I was doing. He emphasised to me what he couldn't do and what many, many others couldn't do. Well, stay dedicated and stay disciplined and have that same work ethic. I often remind him of that when I see him, of how we kept me straight.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Go on.
No, I think that's such a powerful anecdote, and it reminded me of a couple of conversations I've had on this podcast. I remember speaking to James Kerr, who wrote the book Legacy, which
the book.
Yeah, amazing book, right? And it's about the All Blacks and what their culture and why they're so successful. And I remember something he told me is, imagine you're chipping a big block of rock, right? And you've got a hammer and you've got a chisel and you're tapping away. And on the 100th tap, the rock breaks. But it wasn't that 100th tap that did it. It was the 99 before where you didn't feel you were getting anywhere. So that was one thing. There was another guy I spoke to, John Kerwin, Sir John Kerwin, knighted for services to mental health, another All Black, funnily enough. And he, when he was learning to be a decent rugby player, he struggled to change direction at speed. And his dad said, are you willing to pay the price? And basically he went out and trained, but his dad made him work extra. And he's like, if you want to put in that effort, you've got to pay the price somewhere else. So it's like priorities and sacrifice. And even in my own life, I've mentioned before that I was doing sales for a long time. And then when I wanted to get back into broadcasting and radio, I had to take a job on a Saturday where I worked for free for a year alongside my normal job. So it's a little bit like yours, but not quite as intense. But, you know, I was giving up my social life and actually it was costing me money. I wasn't earning money. It was costing me money. And then at the end of that year, it was a long year. In hindsight, it went like that. But at the end of that year, then I was got an opportunity to then get back doing what I wanted to do. So that old saying, pay the price, you know, put in the effort because you never know when it's going to pay off. And that just, I think you summed it up beautifully with your story there. So I just think that's such a valuable lesson. Before we get onto your revenge and all that kind of stuff and my psychological analysis of what went wrong, should we say, I just want to have a quick word about some of your techniques and your dad and stuff, and particularly the visualization side. Now, this is something I spoke about at length with Nick Faldo, but I read that sometimes your dad would get you to drive all the way, let's say, to like Newcastle or something like that, just so that you could see where you would fight. And you'd be like, why have we driven all the way here? But it'd get you there so that you could visualize yourself being in that situation, fighting and winning. So you clearly, like, visualization for you is a massive thing, isn't it?
So visualization is a term what's brought to light more often these days in different sports fields. Certainly when I've been reading, you know, books, including that one, Legacy, you talked about there. But I didn't realise visualization was a thing until I got until around 16, 17, when, you know, I started reading other people's autobiographies and going a little bit deeper. Now, as a young amateur, my dad had started getting involved with the boxing and he'd started doing a bit of coaching and whatnot. And he used to drive up to Newcastle, drive over to Liverpool, drive down to... We once went as far as Stevenage. And I'm like, Stevenage from Leeds is a fair old drive. And, you know, we had a good bit of crack along the way, like, bit of banter, you know, father and son bonding and whatnot, but long way just to go book a Premier Inn. Now, I mean, my dad's pretty old school, and we didn't get his laptop until I was around 16, and we had Yellow Pages, and he'd normally phone up people, and we never shy of picking up the phone and speaking to people, but I thought, why don't you just pick up the phone and phone an hotel and book it there? And he's like, no, I want to get used to route. And we'd drive along, you know, we'd be talking every now and often. He'd be like, how are you feeling? You're all right. Yeah, it's not the longest drive, this. So I'd be used to the route and the journey. Then we'd find a local hotel. And then after that, he'd say, come on, let's go find venue. Now, you'd always have an idea of where the venue was going to be, you know, a week or two in advance. So normally go down and book an hotel a week in advance. And my dad's got gift at gab. So no matter who was in that leisure centre, because normally it was in a leisure centre or you know, like a fancy hall or whatever, he'd always be able to talk him over and you know, oh, my lad's boxing here next week, and do you mind if we have a look, love? Yeah, no worries, blah, blah, blah. Remember one time we were fighting at Liverpool Olympia, and he was braying on all different doors, they were all locked up, and next minute, what are you bloody hell doing? And they were like, oh, listen, next minute, they've all opened it all up, and we're having a look around, but he'd say, yeah, looking around. Do you know where they're going to put the ring? Yeah, I think they're all about sitting the ring up there, and all right. Do you know where they're going to have change rooms? Come on, Josh, let's go have a look. So that's where change rooms will be, and I think they're going to use this room and that room. Right, okay, right, all right, nobody's. And we'd probably spend about 10, 15 minutes around these venues, like I say, leisure centres, just having a look, going to look at change rooms, and like, change rooms are change rooms. There's a shower and a toilet. Why do you need to have a look at it, Dad? But then on the week of the fight, when everyone's talking about it, when your school pals are talking about it, oh, you got a fight this weekend, haven't you, Josh? When people in the gym are talking about it, well, you're fighting this weekend, right? Championships, yeah? Then on moments when you're really quiet, when you're in bed, or for me, I used to do a lot in the bath, I'd sit there, close my eyes, and I was able to think of myself walking into the venue. I was familiar with the surroundings. You know, it wasn't alien to me. It wasn't something new. It wasn't something that I'd have to get ready for or prepared for. I'd been there before. I'd think of myself walking to the ring. I knew what the change rooms looked like. I could picture myself getting my hands wrapped, putting my shorts on. I'd lay in the bath and I'd start getting adrenaline rush. The heart would start beating faster. I didn't realise this was a thing, but there is a little bit of science behind this, that we're working pictures in our mind. And obviously, you know, it's what the eyes perceive. It's all pictures. So I'm creating these pictures of what I've seen. Change rooms, like I say, where the sports hall, where the ring's going to be. And I'm dealing with it. And I'm picturing what the fight's going to be. And I can see in my peripheral vision what it's going to be like outside the ring. I'm imagining all these things. A week later, when I get to the venue, I'm not as nervous as probably what I would be if I've not been there, because I've experienced it. Not physically, but up there, I've experienced it. I've dealt with it. And it's something that made me comfortable with preparing for a fight. I'd prepare for how the fight's going to go, certain scenarios. And then I'd always visualise myself, my arm getting raised, and that nice feeling that it gave me after. And that was always a special thing to do. But that carried on into my pro career. I remember when the Leeds Arena was getting built. Now, I'm proud of where I'm from. I'm proud of being from Leeds. And I remember reading the Yorkshire Evening Post and saying, oh, the Leeds Arena's getting built. You know, it's something that's been missing from the city. They can have sporting events there. They can have music events there. And then online, they put a video up of a boxing match being at the arena. It was like a CGI animation video. And I thought to myself, wow, I'd love to fight there one day. You know, if they can have boxing events there, like Ricky Hatton's had all them big fights in Manchester. We've never really had any big fighters from Leeds, but well, if I could one day do something there, then, you know, who knows? And when I used to drive home from work, I used to drive past the Leeds Arena every day, and I'd drive past and I'd look up at it getting built, and I'd think, wow, one day I'd fight there, one day. And I'd go home and I'd sit and think, and I'd like, again, sat in the bath, or maybe just sat in my bed, and like, long before I had an iPhone or a smartphone, I'd sit and just think, and I'd kind of picture people walking up to the venue, people talking, are you off to that Josh Warrington fight? Oh yeah, I am. I'm going. I've got my tickets. Oh, and just a buzz around it. Then it happened. You know, then there were the talks of me fighting at Elland Road for many years. First of all, with Eddie Hearn, then with Frank Warren. You know, it's going to happen. Josh is going to put this massive event on Leeds. And again, I visualised it. I was going down to watch Leeds United matches, and I'd be sat in stands, and I'd be watching the match, but it's in certain moments, I'd just disappear, and I'd picture what it'd be like. You know, a little bit of imagination have to be used, but I'd picture what it's like with a ring there and seats around the stands, and people walking up to it. Oh yeah, we're all buzzing for this. The stand's full. And then the fight itself, I'd picture me getting knocked down, me bleeding from both eyes, me getting hurt, and I would come back from that. But I'd always finish with my arm getting raised. Always finish with my arm getting raised. And I've got a picture on my Instagram. I might have to send you it when we're finished from this, Simon, where I actually went down on the night before the fight, big fight I had at Ellen Road. And I kind of mocked the ring walk. I did a little ring walk. They were all just setting up the ring. I got in the ring, did a bit of shadow boxing. Everywhere is empty and the stadium's empty apart from a few, you know, setting up team or putting the seats down and laying the pitch and whatnot. And I'm shadow boxing in the ring. And the next minute I get down on my knees and I'm visualising winning. And I see myself, I'm telling myself, I'm the new. And somebody took a picture of me doing that. 24 hours later, the exact same pose is right there and done. Now,
amazing.
Yeah, now everybody is not going to deal with like them kind of scenarios where it's, you know, got a massive sporting events up or they're fighting at the local arena. But there's no wrong with giving yourself dreams and hopes. And maybe you want a higher position in a job. There's not wrong with picturing yourself in that new job. Because that energy has got to go somewhere. And I think that once you become more comfortable with that, you'll maybe conduct yourself in that in a manner what makes you strive towards getting that next position, where it's a better place in the office or, you know, getting picked for the team. Start looking for ways to make that happen. Because that's what I was doing. I was just getting comfortable with that. You may be getting nervous before going for an interview. Picture yourself going into that interview. Sit yourself down. Put your suit on, tie on, and go sit with your partner and have a little bit of role play. Or just picture yourself how you're going to talk. Picture a speech. You become more familiar with it. You know, it's like anything. Once we do things and it becomes repetitive, we don't have to think about it. How many times people start driving and when they're first start the driving lesson, they're stalling, they don't know where the clutch is, they don't know where gears are. Once you're driving in a few years, it's like clockwork, isn't it? It just comes natural. And I think that's same with, it's same with life. The more you practice it, the more you get used to it. So that's all I was doing with the visualization. And not only that, I meditate, and I didn't know that was a thing, but just switching yourself, you know, laying down on a bed and just being one at the moment, thinking about scenarios, what are going to come, thinking about your long-term goals, where you want to be, it massively helps you, stay focused.
Yeah, totally agree. Do you know, I thought I couldn't visualize for a long time, and then I had this realization, because I always used to do it and see myself in the third person, if you can imagine. So I would see myself doing something. And then once I went to somewhere, I won't say where it was, just in case my other half gets funny about it. Anyway, but I went to this place with her, and instead of seeing myself separate from myself, I imagined I was seeing it through my eyes there and then. So it was me in that moment, as opposed to me seeing myself, if you can understand what I mean, the difference.
Yeah.
And the emotion I felt was completely different. So I realized for me to visualize effectively, I need to be seeing it through my eyes kind of now, rather than picturing myself seeing it through my eyes. Does that make sense?
Yeah, most definitely. I hear you. I hear you completely. It's not always easy to do. You know, I think it does take a bit of time. I hear you, because I can watch replays back of my fights on TV. And, you know, when I think about the fights, I think of myself in like you say, third-person view of how the TV's cameras are picturing up. But it's a little bit different when you go back to first person. And a lot of times I don't want to erase that memory, first person, but it can happen quite easily when, you know, you're watching so many replays, and especially like the Carl Frampton fight. I've watched them first two rounds back about 1,000 times already, but putting myself into the first person moment now is pretty difficult. I can do it, but it does take some time. And it is a little bit different because you're seeing things that other people aren't seeing. Now, in that third-person view, yeah, thousands of people can see that because you're seeing that body. But in the first-person view, you're seeing things that not many people, well, no one else sees, really. Because
You're feeling them. As soon as
you see them, the heart rate goes up. Because I can, so as I'm talking to you now, I'm kind of going back to that moment with Carl there, and I can kind of feel it. I remember looking to him and seeing his emotion. And in my peripheral vision, I can see some of my friends sat at ringside. I know that my old fellow's just stood behind me here, and my second in command is stood here. I can MC's just stood over here to left hand side of me, and referee stood in that corner. You know, and it's like all these things I'm seeing, and I can at the same time I'm looking at Carl. Every time I look at him, my heart goes a little bit more. Yeah, and it's brings you back to the emotions, but I'm used to that. But you can kind of get used to that when you haven't been in that situation. And sometimes it might take a little bit of imagination, and sometimes it's not always going to be exactly how it works out to be. But, you know, if you can picture that, then, listen, I think it's a massive, powerful tool. I think I remember reading about a study in a book that I read, Winners by Alistair Campbell. And I think in the book they said that they got a load of basketball players to practice, and they got a load to do no practice at all, and then they got a load to visualise practice. And after around 3 weeks of this study, those who practised improved from around 45%. Those who didn't practice at all didn't improve. But those who visualised had improved around something like 38%.
Yeah,
that's phenomenal to say that you've not picked up anything physical, not taken yourself to a court and done it physical, but it's all been there.
Yeah.
You know, it just goes to show that magical things can happen up there.
Yeah, definitely. Magical things indeed. Right, last couple of bits, Josh. So obviously we've spoken about your fight with Carl Frampton.
If you can see this is the picture, by the way.
Oh, that's right. Class. Yeah, oh, mate, you got to send me that. That's going out with...
That's night before, yeah. And that's the next day.
That is amazing.
So, night before, Friday night, around 6:30 at Ellen Road. The next night.
Amazing.
Same pause, man.
Mate, yeah. You've got to send me those two pictures.
I will do.
You've got to send me those two pictures, because that is powerful. Right, last couple of bits, Josh. So we've spoken about, obviously, a big fight with Carl Frampton. So in terms of Maurizio Lara, right? So here's my theory, right?
Go on, Simon. Let's
see so obviously, it was a completely different scenario. Yes. We're in lockdown. There's no one there. The fact that you were defeated was a huge surprise. Everyone's saying he was a heavy puncher, perhaps underestimated from that point of view. But I know you've said that you felt more nervous even before certain spars than you did before that fight. Yeah. But what I found was really interesting was the bubble the week before. Yeah. And obviously you're in this bubble. And I know that when you do training camps, you like to be able to go home and connect with your family, connect with your wife, connect with your two daughters. And it enables your brain to switch off.
Yes.
And then, but during this bubble, so you're in there for a week, and when you go back to your room, you're still thinking about the fight. So the fight. So there was no switching off.
Yes.
And then I think we underestimate how much energy just thinking and not switching off takes. Again, I mentioned John Kerwin a little bit earlier. He talks about this, he uses this lovely story analogy where he goes, if your computer isn't working at work and you ring IT and go, oh, my computer's on the blink. What's the first thing they say? They always say, turn it off and turn it on again, right? And invariably it works. And we need to do the same with our brain, right?
Yeah.
And my feeling was that you didn't get the chance to do that. Yeah. And so that's why, clearly, when you got out to the fight, you weren't as up as you normally are. You perhaps the energy was a bit lower because everyone was saying that you didn't have that same energy about you. That's my theory. So I reckon the next time around, if you had to go into a bubble, you need to find that way of switching off. But does that resonate a little bit with you?
Yeah, most definitely, mate. Most definitely. Now, there's a lot of little factors just like that. Why I was like I was, but certainly in the mindset kind of things, mindset is a massive thing. And I've always wondered what separates us. What separates us when you've got two evenly matched lads, speed, power, fitness, skill set, what is that difference? How can one lad just be able to give up a little bit more and it's just up there, it's up there. Now, me for mindset, it's always been a massive part of my tool. I think it's got me to the stage where I'm at now. You know, I've, I don't think I'd have been a world champion if I didn't have the mindset that I had. And I've had to adapt it, like I said to you earlier, over the years of fighting in small odds to go into big crowds. How do you deal with the pressure of so many people screaming and shouting? How do you deal with expectation? And this situation was a little bit different, fighting without any fans there. Now, some people say you might got beat because nobody fans there. Maybe, you know, some of that might be right, but I think a lot of it for that week was exactly what you said there. So for me, I don't go away for fights. I don't go away for training camps. I've had to fight abroad before, but when, you know, I've done my media obligations or I've done an open workout, I can go back and I'll be with people I can just relax with. Being in that bubble was nothing I've ever experienced before. For instance, I was down there. As soon as I arrived at the hotel, I got an adrenaline rush. I got an adrenaline rush like I do when I'm fighting the next day. So now, even though I'm fighting Leeds, I stayed in the hotel the night before. So when I arrived at the hotel, I got a build up like I'm fighting tomorrow. But I still had to fight 4 more days there in the bubble. So that started early. Then, you know, I spent 12 hours isolated to my room before I was allowed to come out. When I was out of my room, I had to keep a persona on because my opponent could walk past at any moment. You know, we had social rooms, we had a game room, we had a restaurant area, but other fighters walking past constantly. You know, a member of Sky Sports would walk past. A journalist might walk past who was doing the bubble with us. Matt Costello did bubble with us this time and a fair few other journalists were doing it. Another trainer might walk past who might, you know, tell, you know, your opponent some news or... So you're always keeping your back up. You're always putting a persona on to stay switched on. You're alert. But then you go back to your room to escape and it's you and your thoughts. You know, it's you and your thoughts and everyone who's there with you in your team is all feeling the same kind of pressure because they're all there, you know, head on the boxing, head on the fight on this Saturday. It's not like when I come home in normal circumstances, I come home to my kids and it's daddy. I'm no longer Josh Warrington, the boxer or this whatever. It's just daddy. You know, they don't give a chuff that I'm fighting on Saturday and, you know, in front of thousands of people. They don't give a chuff if, you know, win or lose my belt. They don't give a chuff if people have got money on me. I'm just daddy. And I'll need to make some daft noises to make them laugh. You know, it's a distraction. And I'm switching off right there. And that's why I don't like to go away for camps because I'm Josh to my missus and I'm daddy to my kids. And that was a distraction. So when it comes to the fight night, I'd burnt so much mental energy in that week that I never felt it in change rooms. Normally, when I go to change rooms, it's like, it's on now. But it's been on for the last 4 days. It's been get ready for the last 4 days. So without me realising it, I've kind of got accustomed to it, maybe a little bit burnt out from it. I'm stood behind the setup, and I'm laughing and joking with Ralph, the floor manager, who's radioing through in. We're live, Josh, you're gonna go up onto ramp in 10 seconds. And I'm laughing and joking about not falling over and this and other, where normally I'd have horse blinkers on. I'd be focused, I'd look like I'd be able to run through walls. This one looked like I'm about to go and piss with my mates. You know, I do finally get onto stage and I'm up there and where I normally see people's faces who are screaming and shouting, come on, Josh. I'm just like looking about. I can see just people in hazmat suits and people with masks on the face and just the judges. And it's deathly silent. There's no rush of adrenaline. There's no, this is it. This is what comes down to this moment. It's like, here we go. I get in the ring and... Not a lot of people know this, but I was scheduled to fight 8 weeks later. If I would get through that fight, then I was going to have a big unification fight with Kanju 8 weeks later. I'm looking at him thinking, just get through this one and we're into the next one. Bouncing off of ropes where normally it's like, this is life or death for me. There's no way I'm letting you. And there's no way I'm letting you beat me. There's no way this is it. It would go all this training into this one moment. I'm looking at him thinking, yeah, just get through this fight and we go. So here we go. Even in the fight, Simon, killer instincts were kind of flat. I've gone out, first 10 seconds, bam, 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 bam. I've hurt him. He's on back foot. But I've kind of thought to myself, oh, I'll warm into that. I'll warm into it. Did I think like that against Carframpton? No. I didn't warm into it against Carframpton. It was 100 mile an hour straight away. I got this guy hurt and I'm thinking I'll warm into it. That killer mindset wasn't there. It was kind of less like relaxed, taking it for granted. Whereas he had an opportunity there. He was going to change his life. He was like going over there. He was meant to lose. But no way was he going to let that happen. He was going to let throw absolutely everything at me. And that's what he did. And in little proportions where I was taking it for granted and maybe a little bit burnt out mentally, that, oh yeah, I'll just get through it. It took percentages away from me. And he capitalised on that. Before you know it, 3-4 rounds, it's a level fight. Because he's built confidence. He's warmed into it. He's hit me with clean shots for last 3 or 4 rounds. I've taken them. He's damaged, hitting my punch resistance. And next minute, I'm in backside looking at the lights. Do you know? So,
Yeah.
I can most definitely say that a lot of what you said there had an effect on how I prepared for it mentally.
Just a couple of things that sprung out then, really, from what you've just been saying is two things for me. First of all, the importance of switching off, right? And that can be applied to anyone. I know I do this. If I've got loads of work on, my impulse is just to work. But what happens is my actual productivity, my output just goes way down. So it's much better to work and then switch off. Work, switch off, because you're so much more efficient, right? And you weren't able to do that. So I think that's a valuable lesson for, you know, anyone can relate to. Just graft is not the answer. And then secondly, actually harnessing the power of nerves, harnessing the power of adrenaline, which some people be like, oh, I don't, you know, I'm not used to this feeling. This is me feeling scared or whatever. No, that's an important feeling to have if you're going to perform to your very best. And you didn't have it there, right?
Yeah, most definitely. You know, say it often. Mike Tyson said it in past where, you know, adrenaline's like a fire, and too much of it can burn you. It can burn you, do damage. But just the right amount, you can have a beautiful blaze. What can do, you know, equate to many things: cooking food and warmth. And it's right there, like you say. People might be scared of that feeling, but adrenaline's a natural thing of the body. It's an hormone, and it's a release of the body. What makes us sharper, makes us reactions a little bit quicker, makes us thinking flow a little bit better. You've got to harness it, but same breath there, you have got to have them breaks. And be able to switch off from it.
Yeah.
I know firsthand when after the fight, you know, it's nice to have that break, but as soon as I have that break, a few weeks later, I'm missing boxing, and I'm thinking about boxing like when I first picked up the gloves. I'm excited. I want to try this. I want to try that. Then when you get like halfway through the camp, you think, bloody hell, another session. It gets a bit tedious. So often what we do in our camps is, they'll say, you know what, drop off for a few days, have a little bit of a break, switch off. I don't want you picking up your phone or anything like that. I'll do it on my social media, you know, just come off it completely and have someone else run it for me a few days, just because it just gives you, you know, that bit of relief from it. And
you need it. Yeah.
You
need it. Switch the computer off, as JK would say.
Yeah,
right, final question for you then. It's such a good point, isn't it? Final question for you then, Josh. How are you feeling about the rematch? And I'm guessing you're feeling very confident, to be quite honest, between you and me.
Yeah, most definitely. I'm. If I had to fight behind closed doors again, I've experienced it and I've learned from that. I know from where I went wrong, and I know from certain emotions how to deal with them a little bit better. I know what I'd do differently in the initial stages of leaving the change rooms to getting in the ring. When I look at it as like statistic factors, is Mauricio Lara as big a puncher as a Keiko Martinez, an Hisashi Amagasa, a Carl Frampton? No, I don't think he is. Has he got the same boxing ability as a Carl Frampton, Lee Selby, a Kid Gallard? No, I don't think he does. I don't think I've dropped down a level overnight or in the 12-month bubble. I don't think I've dropped down that level, you know. I don't think you you can just drop from Premier League to League One that quickly. And that's no disrespect to Mauricio Laura, but I feel that 99 times out of 100, I beat him. With the exception of being February 13th when he beat me. And I feel very, very confident of you know, getting the rematch. I just look at that fight and I watch it back a little bit frustrated when I'm thinking, why are you doing that? And why are you doing that? But at the same breath, I know why I did them and I know the feeling of when I was in there and when I was doing them. I knew it was wrong, but I was just missing a fair few things. So when the rematch comes, I know the same kind of mentality I'll need for delivering an A-class Josh Warrington.
My feeling is it's going to be a very different fight. I'm excited for you, put it that way.
Thank you, mate.
But listen, I just want to say, Josh, it really has been a pleasure talking to you. You said at the start, you know, much like Carl, what you see is what you get. And I mean that in the nicest possible way. You're a really humble bloke. You've shared some really valuable lessons. I've really enjoyed talking to you. So I can only just say thank you and just, you're a top bloke and it's been a real pleasure.
Appreciate that. And I think it's too late in my career to start bringing out one-liners like a Conor McGregor at, you know, at press conferences or chucking tables like some other fighters do to get up hype. I think I've just carried on with the same persona because I realise that boxing can change with one punch. And I set off myself, it's in early stages, I set myself goals. I wanted to be British champion. And when I was British champion, then I wanted to be European champion. When I'm a European champion, I wanted to go on and, you know, become a world champion. But it's over a long period of time, you know. But it's baby steps and you're still the same person. But then without realising, your profile gets bigger and bigger and bigger. And I still feel like I'm the same person as I am when I first started boxing. I do realise that I have got the contacts to be able to be a bit more privileged and certain luxuries that other people don't get. But I still feel like same old person, do you know what I mean? And I go around shopping in, you know, city centre and I might be with myself and people are like, where's your entourage? Where's your entourage? And it's like, listen, when boxing's over and done with, no matter if I went on to become a television personality or whatever, or a sports pundit, I'd be the same old person because it's a conveyor belt. You know, somebody's hot and the next person's hot. You know, end of the day, we're all human beings, mate. We're all human beings.
Do you know, I actually think that's the most important point, and that's the thing I want to get across the most, I think, throughout my series with the book and everything like that, is no matter what you achieve, you are the same person. You aren't any better than whoever's next door or posting the letters through your door or, you know, suffering at a hospital, wherever they may be. We're all on a par. But that doesn't also mean don't strive to make the best of yourself at the same time. Those two things are mutually exclusive.
It's a fine balance.
But I think you do it brilliant. I think you said it so well there. You are the same person, but at the same time you've strived to be your best the whole time. And I think those two things are what it's all about. So yeah, just again, Josh, it's been a lot of fun. Thanks a lot, mate. Appreciate it.
Thank you, mate. Top man.
Thanks very much for listening to this episode with Josh Warrington. Some of the key takeaways for me from this conversation include the importance of making good choices, even when you feel like you're not making progress at the speed you would like, because you just never know how far you are from breakthrough. Remember the importance of taking breaks and switching off, and harnessing the power of visualization before an important event is a massive advantage. I'd love to hear which lessons impacted you the most, as I will then select them for a new feature, which is a shorter episode, which I'm releasing at the end of each week, focusing on one specific lesson from podcasts past and present. And I'd love to hear your thoughts. I'm at Simon Mundy, M-U-N-D-I-E, on social media. And finally, are you signed up to my newsletter yet? Monday on a Monday. This week, I'm talking about visualization and how to get out of your own way to let your nervous system settle, among other things. Every week, three of the best life lessons from 3 years of these interviews. Anyway, that's it for now. Thanks again. And until next time, goodbye.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.